Now, Chuck, about anything.
You want to go out of the kitchen?
No, is it raining now, or was it when you came in?
Why don't you move toward the kitchen and talk in a normal tone of voice, and let's see if it'll
turn. The kitchen? Do you take cream and sugar, Maury, in your
Yes,
coffee?
I do, Maury.
Okay. Well, Johnny did say something.
I'm over there.
I feel real stupid. You know,
yeah,
Johnny,
I
was trying to keep real quiet all the time.
Yeah.
He's talking. I thought he had the
tea pot. When we started, I was so hammy that I was talking so loud it sounded awful, yeah.
Oh, you talk too loud.
I had the mic too close.
Oh. Whatever, man.
Let's see what happens. This is Friday, August 6, 1971. Ray, we were talking about reminiscences of photographers and their eccentricities. What comes to mind?
Well, newspaper photographers in the 20s and 30s and into the 40s were an entirely different breed of person than I've ever known. They were an entity all of themselves. They were fine, you know, craftsmen, very brave. They were taking gangsters' pictures and getting clobbered as a result, but that didn't faze them. They'd do anything, go any place to get a picture. But aside from getting the pictures, their lives were a little bit complicated. For instance, there was a murder on what was then Rowena in Detroit, now Mac, in a very fancy blind pig. A St. Louis hoodlum had come to Detroit to visit, and apparently some old friends caught up with him and shot him at the bar in this speakeasy. So shot him several times and killed him. We were out on the story, and I learned later from my photographer that he went back after we had left and talked to the cop that they left guarding the place, and said to him, "Look, do you have a family?" And he said, "Yes, he had three or four children." And the police were paid very little in those days. This was about 1933 or two. And there were a lot of wonderfully thick and tempting looking steaks and roasts in the refrigerator of this blind pig. So my photographer said, "Look, let me take some of these out to your house. They're only going to be thrown out." And the policeman, who was young and didn't know much about procedures, didn't want to, probably, said, "Go ahead," and he gave him his address. So my man took the steaks, a few roasts out to his house, and went back to this place whose name is the Star Club in a truck. It was surprising, cop on guard a little bit. And he also had the photographer had a friend with him, and they backed the truck up, and the policeman asked him what they planned to do. He said, "That little piano in there, there's a piano the entertainers use, and it was moved around from table to table, and it's quite small. He said, I'm going to take that home to my little girl. She's just learning the piano, and it'll be nice for her, and she'll be very happy with it." And the cop said, "Well, what, you can't?" And he said, "What do you mean I can't?" He said, "Well, I'm not supposed to let anything out of here." So my guy says, "You let the steaks out, goddammit. You're going to let this out, too." So they had a terrible argument with my man threatening everything, but the policeman, to his eternal credit, stood his ground and wouldn't let the piano out, but he made a terrible enemy out of my photographer, who really thought that he was wrong, that he was double-crossed. He was the same one who was with me in Hamtramck one time. We went with the sheriff's office, who decided, to, because of newspaper publicity, to raid a number of houses of prostitution. And of course, when we arrived at the houses, there wasn't anybody in them. They'd all been tipped off. And however, my photographer found a big wicker, what do you call it, wash basket in the first house we went in, and I noticed them throwing dresses in the thing. And then the next house, more dresses. Finally, he had a whole, the thing was just over, you know, just flowing over with dresses. And I said, what in the God's name are you going to do with those? He said, take them home to my wife. And I said, nah, whore's dresses. He says, how the hell is she going to know where they came from? But he, you know, this was a proper procedure with him. He did. She was very happy. And so he had great consideration for her, she thought. He, his backyard, you could hardly get in. I was there one time. Photographers always had to make a stop on the way to an assignment. They'd have to take their laundry or go home and get their laundry. Or, you know, there'll always be something that holds you up, it seems. This one time he stopped for his laundry, I guess, so I saw his house in the backyard. And it was a very nice place, except there were huge roadside tables and stands, property of the state of Michigan. And I said, this, you bought these from the state, I suppose. He said, no, I picked them up along the road. He says, wonderful, we have the kids from the neighborhood in here. And had big picnics.
Someone carelessly left them.
They left them on the side of the road. They were stamped, you know, property, state of Michigan. But he got a lot of use out of them, probably more use out of those tables than the kids in that neighborhood than if he had left them in their original spot at the road roadside. Do you want to shut it? The newspapers used to work on the theory, I guess, that photographers couldn't write or couldn't count because it was a reporter's job to handle the expenses on any trip or on any assignment. He was to pay for the photographer's meals and his hotel room or whatever. Well, this resulted in too many fights, and they had to change that because the reporters took to passing bakeries some way and finding a big bag of donuts to give to the photographer just before dinner time. And the photographer was always hungry, but a dozen donuts, which then cost maybe 10 or 15 cents, would tend to wear the edge off his appetite and save $2 or $3 that the dinner cost. The photographers began to, you know, after a few years of being carrying bags of donuts around, eating them just before mealtime, began to get a little suspicious. So that custom was given up, and the photographers were then allowed to buy their own and charge the own meals and pay for their own hotels and charge the company. Photographers had one trait in common. They were mostly, as I recall, garrulous. They were talkative as hell. And to be cooped up in an automobile or any small space for many hours with them was sometimes a little trying because you'd be thinking of the story and its ramifications, and they'd be talking about something entirely remote, probably a childhood recollection, or a recollection from their experiences the night before. But they, I recall one time going up to town, Michigan, Battle Creek, and I was in the car with this photographer from the Times from early that morning till we got to the Post Tavern Hotel late at night. He said, we'll get a double room. And I said, oh my God, no. You couldn't stand it. You couldn't get a minute's sleep. He said, why? I said, well, you know, I'm not back long from the Army, and something happened to me, and I have to have all the lights on and the water running as hard as you can in the bathtub and in the sink in the bathroom, the door open, before I can go to sleep. And I don't think you'd go to sleep that way, so he agreed to get another room. That's the only way I got any rest at all. He'd have talked all night. They talked to everybody. We got in a little town one time. It was a very, very secret assignment. Nobody was to know that we were from a newspaper or what we were doing there, and I had to get an address. So I said, you wait in the car. Don't talk to a soul. I impressed upon him the secrecy of the thing, and I'm going to the post office and see if I can rustle up an address. So I did, and when I came back, my photographer was not in the car, but I saw a pool room, and I headed directly for the pool room, and he was there. And he wasn't only there, but he was showing all the people hung around the pool room how to operate his camera. Yeah, he was explaining to them the duties of a newspaper photographer and told them all about the workings of the Times and why we were in town and a little bit about what we were doing there. Fortunately, he didn't know the whole story. But after we finished our work there, I think was that, have I talked about Battle Creek yet?
No.
We shut down for a second. Wait, I'm a little bit mixed up as the weather. Well, fortunately, we got what we wanted in a small town with other people actually knowing, but it didn't do my heart any good because I know that our very super secret assignment was almost all over that pool room. This man never stopped talking. I've been riding with him in a small car since early in the morning, and it was late at night when we got to a hotel in Battle Creek. And he said, well, we've got a double room. And I said, no, you won't be able to sleep with me. You know, I just got back from the Army a short time ago, and I hope I get over it, but I haven't yet. I can't sleep at night unless the water's running full flush in the bathroom, in the bathtub, and also in the sink, and all the lights are on. So that, I had privacy. He didn't bother me that night. I slept in a room by myself and got a little respite from the conversation, and I managed to make another excuse the next day and take the train back to Detroit so he could drive. He was married to someone who left notes around all the time, was sent notes to him all the time. They were little love notes, and the other photographer somehow got hold of them. I guess he gave them to them. He was so proud, and they kept them. They're interesting. She was a former burlesque actress, I understand, and she... Well, writing, she probably danced better than she wrote. She didn't write too well. But she wanted to come down and see the newspaper, and he wouldn't bring her down. He had told me this, that he didn't think that it was his wife's place to come down to a man's business establishment. However, on Easter, as a special treat, Easter Sunday, he did bring her down. He got all dressed up in a white suit for Easter. She was in her finest attire. And on holidays and Sundays, we used the back, the elevator in the back of the building and to get up to the city room. The front lobby was in the front elevators, remember, were open. So it was a rainy day, and they got on, and we had temporarily operating that elevator at that time a fellow who weighed about 300 pounds. He had his glands sort of ran away with him, I guess, and his mental powers weren't gargantuan, but just the body. liked this photographer, and when the two of them got on, I guess, in an effort to show his high regard for the photographer, he put his arm around him and squeezed him, and he squeezed him so hard that the photographer fainted and fell into a puddle of water that had been dragged in from the wet streets outside. The elevator by this time was at the sitting room floor, and the door opened. The woman, the wife, terrified, ran out screaming, "He's murdered my husband, he's murdered my husband." Now, a lot of odd things happen in a sitting room, but this did startle the two or three men who were at work there at that time, and they went back to the elevator and saw that it was just our photographer lying in some water, so they pulled him out on dry ground and assured her he'd be all right, which he was in a little while. And the fellow who almost caved in his ribs was remorseful, you know, like an ape is after the ape has done something wrong. He didn't intend to hurt him, he just liked it. And he couldn't understand why the wife called him the vile name she called him. I guess I shouldn't say that. There were probably just a few terms of endearment she picked up from the burlesque circuit.
Ray, what about Mr. Logan and the Ohio Lieutenant?
Well, Mr. Logan was a photographer, Floyd Logan, who was really a good craftsman. And he, his only handicap was he was deaf, and he sometimes got the assignments all mixed up and took pictures of the wrong people, which resulted not only in confusion in the office, but sometimes some unhappiness for poor Mr. Logan. We were down in Columbus, Ohio, the Ohio State Penitentiary, had a terribly tragic fire. 342 inmates were burned to death in this fire, and the remaining prisoners took over the prison, and everything was in a terrible turmoil. They were getting the National Guards. They hadn't come in yet. They tried to send some city police in, but when they were within two blocks of the penitentiary, I guess word got to the inmates, and they began screaming and hollering because the most unpopular person to any convict is a policeman, unless a judge is an exceptional SOB and he might crowd out the cop. But the police then realized that was a mistake. They couldn't do anything, so they went back directing traffic or closing up, you know, a widow that kept her children fed by selling whiskey illegally because it was during Prohibition. Logan, we wanted to get some pictures inside, so I had some passes, and I made one out to the bearer, and I signed the warden's name. Now, that might have been I don't think the warden knew about this. Maybe I didn't have time to tell him, but I figured I was doing him a kindness because I don't think that warden could write even his name. I'm pretty sure he couldn't, but I could be wrong. At any rate, I gave it to Logan and got him inside the gate, and I saw that he was getting along well in the prison yard. One inmate was carrying his heavy photographer's case, another was pointing things out to him, and they seemed to be giving him the red carpet treatment. So I went back into the main office of the prison where the governor was just opening a board of inquiry into what caused the fire, who was responsible for all the deaths, and I was to cover that. Well, the door suddenly opened after we were underway, and it was my photographer, Mr. Logan, with his camera broken. He was bleeding slightly from a cut above his eye. He looked disheveled, as they say. And he yelled, you know, he didn't realize he was talking so loud. He yelled, "Ray!" And I got up and tried to go out and talk to him in the hall quietly. But before I could leave the room, he said, "Them bastards are tough out there." They were lifers, of course, and robbers and rapists. And he told me what happened. It seems that that he was getting along fine, but he got over to a part of the prison called White City, and this is where the toughest inmates were housed. When he got there, one of them walked up to him and said, "How'd you get in here? Are you a stool pigeon for the warden?" And he said, "Yes." So they didn't quite accept it. They repeated it, and he then understood, so he showed him the pass, and he said, "What's your name?" He said, "Logan." The guy says, "Look at this lying bastard. He says his name is Logan. Right here it says his name is Better." Saw the pass, which I'd written. So they kicked the hell out of him, broke his camera, and he left the prison. It was sort of faulty communications there that caused so much trouble in the world, this time between inmate and photographer.
Ray, one standard cliche in movies of the 30s is the surly gangster attacking the photographer. Did that actually happen?
Well, yeah, we used to get in a lot of brawls, unfortunately. Gangsters and others, usually on the other side of the law, would become enraged at the sight of the camera. Now, I think some of them feared that if their picture got in the paper, others would come in and identify them in other crimes. They might have kids in school. They didn't want their pictures in to the neighborhood and the other school children. Their parents would know about the difficulties they were in. Because usually they had a respectable front in the neighborhood where they lived. But whatever it is, even though you knew the person well, he'd blow his top at the side of the camera, no? And photographers were getting punched, and we'd try to save them, and we'd get punched, and it was, we had some pretty good brawls. And it was awfully hard to avoid them, really, because it would start so fast. But one photographer in the Free Press, and it's a wonder he didn't wind up getting really punchy, because everyone picked on him. Now, the two largest factions during Prohibition, the latter part of Prohibition, at least in Detroit, were the Purple Gang and another gang that we have no name for, that since has become in some circles popular to call them mafia. Well, I don't know what that means. But they were of Sicilian descent, or Italian, and the Purples were Jewish descent, or were Jews. And Moss looked like could pass as either an Italian or a Jew. He was Jewish. Well, the Italians would see him and they'd say, "One of our own, son of a bitch," and go after him to kick hell out of him before he could, get him any help. The Jews, if they went of our own people and want to murder him, even if he didn't have his camera, he'd get slugged walking down the street. It has happened to him. He gets slugged walking down the street in Detroit by some of the, Well, he left the newspaper business and became quite successful at taking pictures of little children looking at Santa Claus and Christmas time in department stores. Made a lot of money in that business, which he really started in this country. I think he got about as far away from it. About as far away as he could get from his former environment. And had anything to do with photography, I think. It's innocent little kiddies looking at Santa Claus. But there are many that was, things like this would happen. I remember Jim Salamone and Diamond and Jim Galbani. have a camera would cause people to go berserk. For instance, two men, Diamond Bill Delabonte and Frank Salamone, were being tried for murdering two Grosse Pointe policemen. They were bootleggers, and they had a large shipment on the way over from Canada, and they had 45 automatics in their automobile, and these two Grosse Pointe policemen were walking over toward their car, and the theory was that they didn't want to be caught with the guns in their possession. So they shot and killed the two policemen they were on trial for. Now, I'd known them before that, and all during the trial, the photographers and the defendants and the lawyers and reporters were all friendly, and that's usually the way it is. We're talking all the time and passing news on to one another, and everything was fine. When the jury walked in and pronounced them guilty, announced their verdict that they were guilty of murder in the first degree. And one photographer who had been particularly friendly with them picked up his camera. They became two enraged, berserk men, and it took many police to haul them down and get them back in their cell. And just a few minutes before that, they'd been on the friendliest of terms with this man, and they knew that was his business. They posed for him for pictures before that time. But it was the sight of the camera. It did very strange things to many, many people. And, of course, it was immediately their natural enemy, and they sought to destroy it and the person who was manipulating it. Photographers I'm not complimenting all of them with this, but many of them had a trait in common, and that was they were gregarious, particularly for pretty young girls. They liked their company, they liked their to talk with them, meet them. We go to a small town, or any town, and if it wasn't a story of great immediacy, your photographer would disappear. He'd just go. You wouldn't have a clue. Now, if you'd been around for a while, what you'd do would be to go to the hotel you already had checked in, or one you'd planned to check in, or the most prominent or the only hotel, and ask for his room and then go up, and he'd be there. But with him would be one or two girls, and they'd be nude, and he'd be taking their picture because he'd be going to get them into the movies. This was really, it was just a routine. It happened almost every time. Every time the guy disappeared, that would be the story. And then you'd be introduced as the director or some insane thing, and you'd leave because you'd want to get kind of going on whatever you're up in this town for, get the work done, and you'd let him know when he was needed on the story, and he'd be prompt in getting there. He'd give up his newfound friends to come and do some work. But they had a great... Much of that, a great collection of hopeful movie queens at, you know, the age of, how old, 22 or 20 or something. It was another trait. They were pretty good at that. Their best pictures were those. Much better than anything they took for the paper.
Ray, am I right in assuming that photography played a much larger role in newspapers in the pre-television era?
Yes, a very important role. There just almost had to be pictures to accompany every good story. And a lot of stories that weren't so good. And the person who went out on this story, the reporter, photographer, would be expected to come back with still art if the person were not available to have his or her picture taken. I mean, if you were dead, or, you know, in the hospital, they couldn't get their picture taken. Just come back with still art, and this sometimes posed a problem. You'd have the methods used to get that sometimes might be called extreme. I've heard of cases where the person from the paper would ask the lady of the house, please get him a glass of water, and when she came back, he and the big picture that had been on the piano of her daughter would both be gone because she'd refused to give a picture. And often, the reporters would come back with pictures, and incidentally, if the people were cooperative, you took every picture, not just one, but every picture of the subject, so your opposition wouldn't get any, and then sent them back after the reasonable length of time, which means the story was no longer of any interest. But often the picture would have to be identified in the morgue if the person had been killed, murdered, say, and you didn't know him, you didn't have anybody who could tell you, yes, this is a picture of that person. You have to go to the morgue and get all the attendants around and have a consensus as to whether this was the one. We had only once that I know of did we print a picture in all the years I was on papers of a dead person without saying the person was dead. And that was this man who escaped from Crown Point with Dillinger, with John Dillinger. Do we have that? We don't have it. Dillinger broke out of the jail in Crown Point, Indiana, and using a bar of soap, which he's carved to make look like a revolver. And he took with him another inmate, a 6'2", very black man. Obviously, they weren't going to stay together because they'd be too easily detected. The hunt for Dillinger was intense. And one day, I got a call from the office up to Port Huron that the man who escaped with Dillinger had been shot by the police. So, up there, and he was in the hospital, unconscious, but they were still questioning him as to where Dillinger went, where he was he with him, was he in Port Huron? I'm sure the man didn't know what he was being asked. My photographer had some difficulty, I guess, getting there, because by the time he arrived, the man was dead, but his eyes were still open. He didn't look at it, so I said, take his picture, and it's just too important not to have it. So he took it, we used it on the front page of the paper, not mentioning the fact that he was dead, and no one that I know of ever knew it. Actually, I'd been standing there for an hour or so, and he didn't look any different dead than he had looked alive. But they wanted a picture to go with it, and preferably if it were a picture where with your photographer who's taking. It had to be an action picture. That is, just not just someone looking into the camera. You'd have your subject, if possible, doing something, getting undressed, shaving, telephone. That telephone was used interminably. And or something with action in it. Now, the best pictures, of course, were the ones that were not staged. Some of the staging went quite a ways, but the best ones were the ones that where the photographer was there while the shooting was still going on. The expressions on the faces of the people, the very action, although the the camera stopped the action, they were doing something when the picture was taken. And that was the kind that we, the photographers, were striving for constantly. And that was why it was important for them to get there early in the story.
Do you suppose, Ray, in that famous picture of Dillinger shaking hands with his arm around the warden?
The sheriff. I think it was, yeah.
That was staged at the suggestion of the photographer?
It undoubtedly was. I don't know that to be a fact, but my guess is definitely.
And did the sheriff know good, whatever?
I have a hunch that the sheriff, you know, things like this have been done. A paper would be out to, quotation marks, get someone in office. And, you know, for its own reasons. Maybe the person was a thief and they couldn't prove it. Maybe he was incompetent or whatever the reason. And the photographer, knowing that, would have him, the reporter, would have him do something that might turn up and hit him right between the eyes later, as that Dillinger picture did in Crown and Point. Now, I don't know whether that was innocently staged or whether there's something behind it. I've heard different kinds of stories about it. But if you'll recall, it was the sheriff and some others with Dillinger's arms around each other, smiling into the camera, as if they're all schoolmates and buddies. We had an instance in Detroit. I was down in New York on the extradition of Merton Ward Goodrich for the murder of sex murder of a little girl in Detroit, William Gallagher, in the early 30s. And it was brutally hot in New York, and we, the reporters and photographers, and Duncan McRae, who was then prosecuting attorney and was down for the extradition, and one of his aides, and we were all just dead tired when we got on the train to come back. We got a special car because the prisoner and some police were along, bringing Goodrich back. And before we left New York, the air conditioning had not been turned in the train or needed repair or something, and it was hot. We were all tired. McRae was lying down on a couch in our car. And my photographer, just kidding, they were good friends, took a picture of him lying there sleeping in the thing. Meant to give it to him later, but forgot all about it and had it in his locker. And our paper got in a feud with McRae over his alleged membership in the Black Legion. We had his membership card and signature on it, and all. He denied it, sued us for libel. Well, we got affidavits from the people who took part in his initiation and everything. And however, you know, this was at a much later date than the Goodrich case. And parenthetically, the thing never went to trial. He did not push it. But we became enemies, I guess, the paper and the prosecutor. And one of our editors remembered that picture and put it on the front page with the headline over it, "Oh, another McRae investigation." And then the story was ripping him for all the investigations that he was to have started and never finished, and nothing ever came of. But the picture was taken innocently, and I thought it was hitting below the belt, really. To use a picture, and to use that heading over it, there's no explanation at all.
Ray, what about editorializing by photography?
Well, that was done very frequently, and I suppose still is to some extent in some papers. The artist can do a great deal with a photograph to make the subject look better or look like an idiot. And I recall one paper in Detroit was having a feud with a prosecuting attorney out in Macomb County. And pictures, when they used a picture of him, he would be completely bald, although in real life he did have some hair. And his ears would be twice the normal size. And he looked like a moron. Now, I assume that the artist had done all the work on that. On the other hand, the artist could make the combination of the photographer and the artist could make the person look much more intelligent, much more acceptable, and he does look naturally. There are, yes, a photographer and the artist can make him look completely ridiculous. And many a person, I think, has lost out in an elective job because of the photographs that have been printed. Of course, the reaction probably, the reaction of people who didn't want their pictures taken and whose pictures were taken probably wasn't as great after the bulbs came in. See, before that, they took flash powder shots, and they were terrifying things. Instead of a light bulb, the photographer had attached to his camera sort of a metal container that was, oh, maybe 8 inches long and an inch high, and he'd fill that with flash powder. Now, maybe I'm exaggerating the amount of powder, but it was a lot of powder. And then attached to that was a trigger which sparked it. That was all attached to his camera. He'd pull the trigger, the spark would hit the powder, and there'd be a terrific roar, accompanied by a huge cloud of dirty smoke that would ascend. Now, the subject didn't, as a rule, know much about this, didn't know the noise was coming, didn't know the smoke was coming. And it was a terrifying thing, they'd react violently quite often. Even very nice people, into whose homes the photographer would go, take a picture of the daughter who was going to be married, for instance, who she'd be at a future date. She'd be for the newspaper pictures. She'd have her bridal gown on. They'd have some flowers around to make the setting look very nice for the society page, the photographer go in. The house probably has just been redecorated because of the upcoming nuptials. So the photographer would go in with the society reporter, and they couldn't tell these people because obviously they wouldn't let him take the picture. He'd take this picture setting off this bomb-like noise and the smoke that would ruin their home, scare the young bride out of her gown practically, and of course the bride's mother and father, if he were there, any brothers and sisters would want to lynch the photographer because they just couldn't have a wedding in that, or a wedding reception or anything else in that house with all the dirty walls and ceilings from the powder. It ruined more homes and more reputation and scared more people. But in the, came the 30s and the flash guns were eliminated in favor of the bulbs.
The flash powder also posed a physical menace to the photographer himself.
Yeah, many photographers were badly injured. They had parts of their hands blown off. Many of my friends had happened to in Detroit. Precisely how it would happen, I don't know, but in the explosion, fingers, her hands would be in the wrong place. And, of course, when an accident like that would happen, on top of the rest of it, it was really bedlam in the bride's home or the county jail. Oh, one of my first assignments, I recall, I had to go to the psychopathic ward of receiving hospital, the women's section, early one morning with a photographer to talk to a woman who was a bit disturbed. Well, when we walked in, we awakened the other, this was a large ward. We, her very presence, I guess, awakened most of the other poor sick people in the ward. And I talked with this woman patient and got the information I wanted. Incidentally, she was rational, even though she was in the psychopathic ward. Then I told my photographer to go ahead. And he took the picture, setting off his bomb in the ladies' madhouse at receiving, and I thought we wouldn't get out alive. They were screaming and crying and tearing up of sheets, and they were trying to get through the bars and the windows. It was a horrible scene. So we made our way out of there and, you know, left to the